From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on all of the news that made headlines around our region this last week. A lot to get to. And our panel today, Kevin Richer, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter for the Idaho Statesman, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, Kelsey Mosley Morris, national reproductive rights reporter with States Newsroom, as well as Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com. Now, we are going to spend the next couple of minutes talking about a trial that is, of course, taking national headlines, happening right here in Ada County in Idaho. So, Nate, I want to start with you, bring you into the conversation. As we mentioned, you are with East Idaho News, and your newsroom is the are the folks who actually broke the story of Lori and Chad Daybell and brought this to national media outlets, national attention. The trial of Lori Daybell started this week in Ada County. If you are not familiar with who we're talking about, she is the East Idaho mom who is accused, along with her husband, of killing two of her children, Kylie and JJ. Nate, I know the lawyers, I believe, are in their third day of trying to seat a jury. I do want to get to that in a moment. But first, can we start with a ruling that District Judge Stephen Boyce made yesterday in regards to JJ's grandmother? So first, let's go back to, I believe, late last week when Lori's attorneys had an emergency hearing basically saying they didn't want Kay Woodcock to be in the courtroom during the trial.
Yeah, this has to do with a law in Idaho that prohibits witnesses from observing other testimony during a trial. Mm-hmm. And there are some exceptions to that rule based on whether you're immediate family. The problem here is that there isn't really any immediate family for the victims. You have for both JJ and Kylie, both their fathers are dead. And Lori is the one on trial. The only immediate family is their brother, Colby Ryan. But Kay and Larry are grandparents, which don't qualify as immediate family. So under Idaho law, they wouldn't have been allowed in the courtroom during portions of it where other people were testifying, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But what the judge has done is there is a provision that allows for the court to appoint a representative for each victim. And that's what's happened here. So Kay Woodcock, who is JJ's grandmother, is now been designated as JJ's representative. And Tylee's representative is actually going to be Lori's sister, Summer Shiflett.
Hmm.
So there is going to be some extended family there. I did talk to Larry Woodcock. He's disappointed about not being able to be in the courtroom for some of this testimony, but he says he's at peace with it. He knows everything is going to work out. He's excited for the trial to begin.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth mentioning for folks who may not understand a lot of times legalities, is that this is actually really common that if you are called to be a witness in a trial, you normally are not allowed to sit in on the trial until you've been released from being a witness. So that, yes, that can mean that either you've testified and then the attorneys have decided, all right, we're not going to call this individual back, so therefore they can sit in on the trial, or they decide we're not going to call them at all. And then again, you can sit in on the trial.
Exactly.
This is right. I mean, it's very common. I think the issue here for a lot of folks was really probably that emotional component of it, where Lori's attorney said that, quote, the Woodcocks were not victims, right?
Yes.
Because that a lot of times there is that exception when you are a victim or when you are immediate family. And so, Nate, I'm curious then when the and I know that your other colleague, Nate Eaton, has been in the courtroom all week. But did Nate say anything about kind of reaction when the judge ruled yesterday that that Kay, the you know, JJ's biological grandmother, could sit in on the trial?
Reaction from other people or from them?
From them, but also maybe from, you know, from within the courtroom. I mean, did Lori have any reaction that we know of or anything like that?
No, she didn't. She didn't really show any reaction to that. But Kay expressed us some profound feelings of relief at being able to be in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it was interesting too, Nate, that, you know, when this argument was being made that Kay in particular was not a victim, you know, Larry and Kay were the people who brought this, you know, JJ and Kylie's disappearance to authorities. I mean, the ball got rolling on this entire situation because they couldn't get in touch with their grandchild, correct?
Oh, for sure. They've been central to this case from the very beginning, and I'd even say they've been the face of mm-hmm. the victims for this case, because they've been on camera so much, they've been on media outlets all over the country, essentially saying, this is what happened to my grandchild, we've got to do something.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's go into what's happening right now in the courtroom. Because this, they're still trying to seat the jury. Now, the trial officially began on Monday. And mm-hmm. what they've been doing all week, Nate, is trying to find a fairly large jury pool.
Yes, and they have actually done that now. As of this morning, they have a total of 18 people. 12 jurors and 6 alternates. 10 of them are men, 8 of them are women. And so have all been ordered. We don't know who's the alternates and who are the regular jurors, but they've all been ordered to report at 8:30 Monday, and they've all been given very, very strict instructions that they cannot talk to anyone or have any sort of communication about this case with in any way.
Will they be sequestered? And my apologies, folks. I may cough a little bit. I'm getting over a cold, so so I apologize, and I'll try to be off the microphone. But Nate, can you explain that, please?
No, it doesn't sound like they are going to be sequestered. There was originally some talk that they would need to be sequestered, but during this week that was discussed, and it was decided that as long as they don't talk to anyone, there's no reason to keep them as away from everyone else.
Okay. So you said they have whittled this down to the 18, because as of last night, they had reached that goal of 42 potential jurors. And then they were hoping today to get those remaining jurors. So that's what they must have been doing this morning.
It was, and court has now adjourned, and, our reporters are on their way homes for the weekend, so we're happy about that.
Yeah, and okay, so do we know anything, before I let you go, Nate, mm-hmm. about the, so Monday morning, they reported 8:30, then the opening statements began. Do we know anything as to what that may look like or entail on Monday?
We don't know a lot. We're hearing some rumors that some of the family are going to be witnesses first.
Okay.
But we've got nothing confirmed.
Okay. Well, as always, we really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this. As we said, I mean, your newsroom has been on top of this from the beginning, and I know you will be continuing to cover it and giving us updates here. So thank you so much for your time. And not just for you, but I mean, all of your newsroom who have been boots on the ground covering this. So appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. The 2023 Idaho legislative session has officially wrapped up. And Kevin, you were there the entire time. And I know that we will talk more, pretty much, right? I will talk more in depth momentarily about a lot of these laws that were passed. A lot of them quite controversial. But Kevin, I'm very curious, as you look back on the session, what are your main takeaways from what we saw?
Oh, wow. I mean, it was a wild session in the sense that there was so much going on and so many emotional issues, and not just in the education space. I mean, we had really heated debates about libraries and harmful content in libraries and what that means, and how do we want librarians to serve kids. We had that, but we had that, those kind of emotional debates and so many other topics. I mean, abortion, as Kelsey can talk about, and transgender care. I think it was an emotionally draining session to cover, and I think it was probably an emotionally draining session to be a part of, in any capacity, whether you were writing about it or whether you're a legislator, whether you're a lobbyist. It just felt exhausting.
Mm-hmm. And how many days was it, Kevin? Because it was longer than expected.
It did go longer than expected. So really, they wrapped up work for all practical purposes on last Friday. So they came back on Thursday very briefly. We can talk about that a little bit more. But that was the 88th day of the session. So it did run a little bit longer than expected. Probably by a good week or so longer than legislative leaders had hoped for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I know we will get into a lot of that in a minute, but I do, Kelsey, want to bring you into the conversation. As Kevin mentioned, abortion was a major topic of discussion at the State House this session. And there were numerous bills sitting on Governor Little's desk that a lot of folks were paying close attention to. One was what's being called this abortion trafficking bill. So, Kelsey, I know you've been following this. So first, can you explain exactly what this bill, the purpose of it, the goal of it was? And then we'll get into what Governor Little did earlier this week.
So for a lot of intents and purposes, this bill kind of followed the same model as a lot of the bills that we saw this session, which was made it about parental rights, because that's kind of the workaround that they've been using for a lot of these things. There's a general sense that they can't really police what people are doing outside of Idaho borders. And so this really was an attempt to limit some of the ability for minors in particular to be able to seek abortions across state lines. And I think particularly if you think about the fact that we have an Ontario clinic opening up, I think it's open already for Planned Parenthood, which is only about an hour away. I think there was a real appetite to try to mitigate this somehow. So it criminalizes the act of an adult taking a minor outside of Idaho borders to obtain an abortion without their parents' express permission. And so this would criminalize people who were found guilty of it by 2 to 5 years in prison, which is about the same prison length for medical providers under Idaho's abortion law if they're convicted. And I think an affirmative defense was that a parent gave permission for them to go. But, there's been a lot of confusion around what this bill actually does and how far it can reach. And so I think that's part of it. It just sows more doubt in people about what they're actually allowed to do around Idaho's abortion laws.
Okay, so then this bill was sitting on the governor's desk. And what did he then do this week?
He signed it the same day that he vetoed the library bill. And so he accompanied it with a transmittal letter that said, this doesn't attempt to restrict interstate travel. This is all about what's going on within Idaho borders and the parents' right to know what's going on with their child. And so I think he was definitely couching it as, I don't read this as an interstate travel type of bill because that would be unconstitutional in my view, I think is what he was probably trying to say.
Right.
And so he was okay with moving it forward.
I do think that's interesting, Kelsey, that he used that language in particular, that this does not impact interstate travel, because he's absolutely right. That is completely unconstitutional. You cannot, I mean, we have the right to travel, right? But even with him putting that in his, you know, letter, I mean, that's exactly what it does. It restricts interstate travel. And Kelsey, the ACLU of Idaho, correct, has already come out and said that they will sue over this.
So there's a little bit of confusion around the lawsuits that are going on. The Planned Parenthood Great Northwest kind of said, you know, we will absolutely be challenging this at some point, but I'm not sure what the timing of that will be. They have already come out with a lawsuit against Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador for an opinion that he issued stating that physicians who refer people across state lines for an abortion are violating Idaho's abortion laws. And that is a more express violation of interstate travel than 242 actually is. So they're kind of putting the priority right now on that lawsuit, because I think, in my opinion, it's a little bit more straightforward than 242 actually is. Mm-hmm. And they've kind of dubbed that opinion that he issued the Labrador interpretation of this law. And so I think they're going to move forward with that. And in part because also I think 242, the abortion trafficking bill, is really hard to enforce. And nobody's really sure how they're going to do that. I think there's a lot more. Go ahead.
Can we just talk about that for a minute? Because that's the thing that I think, I mean, I've thought about this. I am sure I am not the only person who has thought about this, right? Is that it's like, okay, so let me get this straight. Are we going to have state troopers at every road, at every border? Are we going to have troopers at the airport? And what if you are a girl under the age of 18, not with her parents, traveling? Are you going to stop her and make her take a pregnancy test on her way out of the state and then make her take one when she comes back? I mean, that's the thing, is it's like, I look at this and I don't understand how you could actually enforce this unless somebody, you know, comes out and says, oh, this happened, right? And they report it.
Right. You know, when I talk to advocates, it seems like a lot of what they think the intention of these types of bills are is to sow confusion and to sow intimidation to make people afraid to seek abortions anywhere else. And I think that is ultimately what they see as the intent of these bills. And in a lot of ways, that's what it's doing, is it's just making people more unsure of what their rights still are, what their options still are. And so, you know, especially for physicians too, they're unsure of what they can say, what they can still counsel their patients to do. I talked to a physician yesterday from Boise who, she's just a family physician, and she said, you know, it really feels like we're being asked to abandon our patients and not give them the counsel that they want and need because we're afraid of being criminalized for it. And what a lot of people have talked about with this law is, parents aren't always, you know, great. They're not always kind of caregivers we'd hope them to be. And if they are the ones who maybe impregnated the female, or maybe are abusive, or, you know, they're just not a safe place for this person to go, their family physician is who they would go to for that advice. And so now it's taking away a lot of those options for people, and it's kind of backing women into a corner when they find themselves in a pregnancy that they weren't expecting.
Before we go to break, can we go back to what Planned Parenthood of the Greater Northwest then said in regards to Raul Labrador's opinion? So at this point, I mean, Kelsey, has there been a lawsuit filed? Has there not? Or they are working on it? Where are we in that regard?
There has been a lawsuit filed against Attorney General Labrador by Planned Parenthood, along with the ACLU of Idaho and of New York. And there's a couple other legal agencies signed onto it as well. There's quite a few clients, as well as two Idaho physicians, one being Dr. Caitlin Gustafson, who was the physician on the three abortion lawsuits Planned Parenthood okay. filed against Idaho's general abortion laws. And one who's new, I can't remember his last name, but both of those physicians have signed on saying this is making our practice more difficult because we don't know what we're allowed to tell patients anymore. I just spoke with a physician last week who had to tell her patient who did IVF, and she had three fetuses from her IVF. And one of them had, I think they call it acrania, which is when the brain does not develop properly.
Right.
And her physician told her, you know, if you want to selectively reduce this pregnancy so that you have the best options with the two that are still viable, you will have to go out of the state to get that done. And so there's kind of confusion now about if you're saying it's illegal in Idaho to do that, then what am I supposed to tell that patient? You just leave them in the lurch. That's the big thing for Planned Parenthood right now is, you know, this is making an already complicated situation even more impossible for our physicians who are already, you know, leaving the state and saying this isn't worth my license.
Right.
So, yeah.
And is the argument then with this lawsuit that has been filed, Kelsey, I mean, not just like it makes the physician's job difficult, but does it go back to what we mentioned, which is this, impeding interstate travel, right? If you can't recommend going out of the state to do something.
Yes. The violations that they mentioned in their lawsuit are of due process and the Commerce Clause. So that one, it's a little bit more straightforward argument for them to make because it's just a lot more blatant in his opinion than it was in the abortion trafficking bill.
Okay, Kevin, I want to go back to some other bills that folks were paying close attention to that were hanging out on the governor's desk. And one, as we mentioned, was pertaining to libraries. So can we start with what this bill was, the purpose of it? And then we'll get into what happened with the governor.
Well, yeah. So the purpose of the bill was to restrict what the bill described as harmful materials harmful to minors, and restrict public libraries and school libraries from allowing minors to have access to those materials. I mean, that was the crux of the bill, was to try to keep bad materials away from young kids. The bill also, and this is part of the controversy, was it created this clause where a parent could seek a $2,500 penalty against a library that violated this this bill, created this private cause of action, which is an unusual legal mechanism. The bill passed the legislature last week. It was the last bill, basically one of the last bills that passed both houses at the end of last week. So it went to Governor Little's desk on Friday. Legislators recessed and they waited to see what Governor Little would do with this bill, among others, to see if he was going to sign those bills or veto them. And then late Wednesday afternoon, about a day before his deadline to act on the bill, Governor Little vetoed it, and he cited a couple of concerns. He did not like the $2,500 private cause of action. He said that would create a bounty system against libraries. He didn't really like the vague terminology of what harmful materials, what that constitutes, what that means. How is that defined? That's where we were left on Wednesday afternoon. Legislators came back on Thursday, as they were planning to. They came back from their recess. And the sole reason they come back like this after a recess is to have the option of trying to override a veto. And they almost did again. This is almost the second veto that got overridden this session. The House took it up. They didn't debate it. They voted on it. And it the override passed the House 46 to 24. It needed a two-thirds supermajority to pass. So one more vote would have flipped it over. And there would have been a supermajority, so the veto would have passed the House, and it wouldn't have gone to the Senate, which had approved this bill last week by more than a two-thirds majority. So if the veto had gotten through the House, there's a reasonably good chance it would have gotten through the Senate as well.
So, Kevin, what was reaction of legislators when Governor Little vetoed this? I mean, And I ask that because, I mean, when we go back to this idea of basically allowing a bounty on books, right? I mean, if a parent is savvy enough, you could walk into a library and hand your kid a book that falls into that definition, right? And have them go check it out and then go get money from the library.
Yeah, I don't know really what the reaction from legislators was exactly, because there wasn't a whole lot of debate. There was no debate about overriding the veto in the House. You did have a couple of Republicans in the House who did flip their vote over. They had voted against the bill when it came up for a vote last week. They supported the veto. One of those House members, one of those House Republicans, is Dustin Manwaring. He's a lawmaker from Pocatello, and significantly, he's a member of House Republican leadership. He's the House caucus chair. And afterwards, after the session, House leadership held a news conference, and Manwaring was asked about his vote, and he said he was supporting the caucus. He was supporting the House by voting to override the veto. And that was the theme that we heard yesterday from House leadership. The idea of overriding a gubernatorial veto is the House asserting itself as a co-equal branch of government.
Mm-hmm. Well, and do you think, Kevin, that we will see more attacks on libraries next session? I mean, it seems to be a theme, not just in Idaho, but across the country. I don't know if that'll die down a year from now or not.
I think we'll absolutely see another library bill next year. You know, in that news conference with House Republican leadership, House Speaker Mike Moyle said, this isn't an issue that's going to go away. It's going to come back. And, you know, I asked, well, what do you think a bill might look like next session? He said, well, I think the big hangup was the $2,500 fine, the bounty, as Governor Little put it. So I suspect we'll see another run at this in 2024. It's an issue that the last two legislative sessions have hung up over library materials. One of the last mm-hmm. issues of the past two sessions has been libraries. So I don't expect that issue's going to go away. I think it'll come back in 2024. It is an election year on top of that. I don't think there's any question that lawmakers are going to take this issue up again.
Well, that will make it an even more interesting session next year, Kevin, with it being an election mm-hmm. year. Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Audrey, I want to bring you into the conversation. You wrote about this, I believe, earlier this week. And I know you've been paying a lot of attention to what's been going on at the Attorney General's office, because there has been a lot of back and forth between the AG's office and Idaho Health and Welfare. Once again, they are at odds. Now, this time, it is because Attorney General Labrador says that he wants to review a child protection case, in particular, a case that involves a family of one of his donors. I know, as I said, there is a lot to unpack here. So can you do your best to tell us what's going on?
Sure. So this child protection case was in the news last year because it was the subject of protests at St. Luke's, downtown Boise, and at St. Luke's Meridian, too. And it involves a child who is the grandson of a man named Diego Rodriguez, who has been a Labrador supporter. He did give to one of his congressional campaigns about $1,000. That was a decade ago. The more key issue here, and this is where it comes down to what people are saying. So Health and Welfare Director Dave Jepson, he had communicated in some emails that that prior to taking office, Labrador had approached him and said he wanted to look at this child protection case and wanted to see the files to see what had happened, and that he believed there had been some missteps, malfeasance, mm-hmm. Including possibly on the part of Health and Welfare. So after he takes office, he once again requests those files, and Jepson says, he's bringing this to a few different people's attention. He says, I'm a little concerned about a potential conflict of interest here. And the reason is that, and this is kind of the crux of what's come up between Labrador's office and health and welfare over the past few months is that Labrador, you know, he tells me he wants to look at child protection cases and that he's looking at several. It's not just this one. And that he believes that it is his job as the attorney general to represent the state, including Idahoans, to make sure that everything's being carried out properly, that his deputies have the best information to provide legal advice and make determinations on these cases. The issue there and why this came up for health and welfare, as well as for the state's liability insurance administrator, who usually coordinates, you know, kind of the legal response to mm-hmm. claims, of which this child's family had filed a claim against the state. The issue is that Labrador would be the person representing the state in this case. So the Idaho Attorney General represents all of the state's agencies, boards, officials. And what Labrador is saying is that he wants to be able to look into how this process works. So at the heart of this is a question of whether the AG's office can both represent the state agencies and the legislature, as mm-hmm. well as investigating their conduct on behalf of the public. So there are concerns about whether that's a conflict of interest or whether it's just an interpretation of what the Attorney General's job is. And, you know, Labrador made it clear when he was campaigning that he wants the office to work for Idahoans, not only for the bureaucracy, is the word that he used, to provide, you know, legal justifications for decisions that are made and things like that. So the statute, Idaho statute, says the AG works for the state's departments. They are his right. clients. But he doesn't think that that's in conflict with how he sees the AG's office, which is more, you know, in cases like this and in cases like the child care grants, which I'm not even going to go into detail on that.
Good, okay.
That he's kind of looking at it as an inspector general kind of role, like what you would see in other states or at the federal level with mm-hmm. an inspector general who kind of checks on, you know, if there's corruption and things like that. So Idaho does not have an inspector general. We have the Office of Performance Evaluations, and then we also have legislative audits that can be conducted. So in this case, OPE, the Office of Performance Evaluations, has issued child protection reports, has issued three pretty in-depth reports. And so the question here is, like, what is the Attorney General's role? Obviously, Labrador sees it as different from the prior Attorney General, who was in office for many, many years. So what this comes down to is Labrador says, you know, Diego Rodriguez is a friend, but he's not a close personal friend. I have a lot of friends as a politician who's been active in politics statewide for many, many years. And I don't have a conflict here. I can handle it ethically and responsibly. And the state's insurance department is saying, we have never encountered this kind of, you know, potential conflict or concern about conflict before, and we don't mm-hmm. know what to do. So it's still up in the air. But I think it's really interesting how this is shaking out with just this one particular case, but in general, as the Attorney General approaches his office as kind of a watchdog, as well as representing the state.
Well, it's interesting to me because, I mean, the state statute's clear, right? That your client is the state of Idaho, its departments, right? I mean, it's that's what you are supposed to be doing. And I mean, when you have attorney generals who are, you know, just deputy attorney generals who are literally assigned to child protective cases through the Department of Health and Welfare, I mean, that seems to be a potential issue, right? or wrong?
Well, that's come up a few times so far. So, and a lot of the DAGs, the deputies, attorney general, deputy attorneys general, they are, you know, they've been working for the office for years. So they're not, you know, people who Labrador hired, but in, you know, in the past few months, they have lost several deputy attorneys general, and the DAG who was assigned, you know, kind of to figure out what was going on in this case, has resigned since. And she had written that she was communicating. Labrador believes that, you know, he can represent us fairly if this goes to court, that he just wants to look at the case files. I have pointed to Idaho rules of civil procedure, which is basically the ethical rules for attorneys to follow in Idaho, and pointed to a couple of different rules where she says, or suggests that this would be a conflict of interest because there is a personal relationship. So usually what would happen in this case in the past would be that it would be kind of conflicted out. So they would hire private counsel, make them special deputies, and those attorneys would be the ones to kind of run the show on the state's defense against the tort claim. And in this case, it's unclear still if that's what Labrador will decide to do. And he said, you know, that's not just my call, but it's, I feel like right now I can handle this just fine. And I just want to see what happened in that case and see if the law was carried out as it should have been.
Okay. Well, I appreciate this, Audrey, for breaking it down for us. Folks, if you do want to really read Audrey's in-depth article on this, go to the Idaho Capital Sun. I mean, we'll link it too, but quite in-depth. And we should note this is the second time since Raul Labrador took office as the Attorney General that he has been at odds with the Department of Health and Welfare. And there is a section in Audrey's most recent article that does talk about that quickly as well. So, Nicole, I think everybody in Idaho realizes for decades now that our state has been one of the fastest growing states in the country. I mean, sometimes the fastest growing state. But the census just came out with some data that shows just how much Idaho has grown over the last 2 years. Can you break this down for us? Because, wow, I was pretty surprised at the amount of growth that we saw.
Yeah, Gemma, there's some interesting information that we got here. So last week, the U.S. Census Bureau gave us some kind of more detailed information. So we already knew that between April 2020 and July 2022, Idaho added about 100,000 new people, which is quite a bit. And nearly half of those people, we learned last week, were in Ada County in Canyon County. So for anybody who's living in the Treasure Valley, you're probably going to notice that there was an increase of about 45,000 people.
Hence why there's so much traffic. And there's so much traffic. Okay, so break this down for us, though, because I wasn't surprised, I guess, when I saw the Ada County growth. And you broke this down in an article that you wrote. What, it grew by about almost 5% in that time frame?
Yes. So Ada County was 4.8% growth.
Okay, gaining nearly 24,000 people, but really almost a quarter of all new residents came into Ada County. However, let's talk about Canyon County. Less people, but percentage wise, a tremendous amount of growth.
Yeah, so it's interesting to look at things in the raw numbers versus the percentage. So obviously, Canyon County has a smaller population than Ada County. And so the percentage that it's growing by is going to differ from the percentage that Ada County is growing by. So in Canyon County, we saw them gain almost 20,000 new residents, which is pretty close to what Ada County added. But in Canyon County, that growth was 8.6%. So their population now is nearly a quarter of a million.
Wow. Okay, so what do we know in regards to where these new residents are coming from?
So the census doesn't have that information tracked for us. We know broad strokes, I guess. So we know most of these folks are domestic migrants, which means they're people who are from the U.S. Idaho doesn't have a ton of international migration. We know most of the counties are seeing a little bit of what's called natural growth. So that's when births outweigh or outpace natural deaths. But by and large, the biggest contributor to any of that growth is domestic migration.
And finally, even though we talked about, you know, Ada County, Canyon County having a lot of growth, right? These 4.8% in Ada County, 8.6% in Canyon County. That does not compare, though, at all to really a lot of our rural areas. Because they weren't the ones that had, when you look at percentages, had the most growth.
Right. And, you know, as I mentioned, when you have a smaller population, like some of our rural counties do, it is easier to get kind of those shocking percentages where, you know, some of them are growing by 7-8%. Our fastest growing county was Boundary County, which is way up the boundary with Canada. They grew by 10.7%, which seems, you know, huge, but that for them calculated out to about 1,300 new people.
Yeah, but that's still a lot when you're looking at a rural county, right? All right, Kevin, I've got about 3 minutes left, and I really want to talk about, in this time frame, the seems to be the ever-beleaguered College of North Idaho. What is going on up there? What is the latest?
Well, there's always a lot going on in North Idaho College. So last week, and this is what I got interested in, last week, the college submitted its response to regional accreditors who have threatened to yank NIC's accreditation, which has a lot of effects on students. If a college loses its accreditation, students can't transfer their credits, they can't get financial aid. It really hurts students if this college were to lose its accreditation. So the college came back with its response, its case for salvaging its accreditation. And I was struck by a lot of what was in that report in terms of how much has happened at North Idaho College and the cost of the dysfunction that we've seen at that campus. Enrollment decreases that total about $1 million in lost tuition and fees because of lost students. Huge increase in liability insurance coverage after the college fired a president without cause. Their insurance carrier decided they didn't want to carry NIC as a client anymore. New insurance carrier charging the college a lot more money. The cost of having basically two college presidents on the payroll. So I wrote a piece on Thursday just kind of chronicling the costs that this college has incurred over the past couple of years, stemming from a lot of questionable decisions that have been made by the Board of Trustees. Where this whole accreditation process stands right now, Gemma, the accreditors are supposed to do a site visit up in Coeur d'Alene. I want to say it's the last week in April. I believe it's going to be June or so before there's a resolution on this accreditation. So the story's not going away.
No, not at all. I want to thank all of our panelists for coming in today and talking with us and getting us updated on everything that happened this week. You can always catch all of them on all of their respective news sites. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I've never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast and its latest series, Taking Cover.